Freddie, in order to keep the Mutual Admiration Society to the minimum, let me just say that, that Freddie's been an outstanding graduate student advisor to me. So, the goal of today's lecture, so Freddie has given you, I think, the global plan. The goal we had for today is to get all of the groundwork, all the zeroth order groundwork, the kinematics, discussion of the symmetries, the objects that are going to make an appearance in the story described, so that we can get going with the real business of talking about the excitement will start. Well, some of the excitement will start tomorrow. So that's my goal for the rest of for this lecture, is to finish talking about some of these kinematic things. So Freddie has told you about how to think about on-shell quantities. He's talked about on-shell superspace and written down some basic amplitudes in that on-shell superspace. So we're going to go back and talk a lot more about explicit amplitudes, but right now I want to shift gears for a second and start talking about some of the symmetries that we expect n equals 4 super Young mills to have in the planar limit, and the appropriate spaces that go with talking about these symmetries. And after we finish that, I'll talk about some of the objects that you might think could be computed related to scattering amplitudes. And I'll talk about leading singularities and also the BCFW recursion relation. So that's the plan. Okay, so let's first talk about the symmetries. N equals 4 super Young mills is classically has dimensionless coupling constant. Quantum mechanically, we know that it's a, in fact, quantum mechanically, a conformal theory. One of the symmetries we expect that scattering amplitudes to have at some level is conformal invariance. Okay? Really, it should be superconformal invariance. Now, whenever you have conformal invariance, so one of the themes in this whole story is to, at every moment, use the simplest possible variables to deal with the objects that you have. And the variables that make the action of the symmetries as manifest as possible. So the ordinary space-time variables, even the ordinary lambdas and lambda tildes that Freddie talked about, are not ideally suited for this purpose for the sake of conformal transformations. Let me remind you what the conformal group is. Apart from the Poincaré group, we have overall rescalings, which is trivial. But then we have the exciting part of the conformal group, infinitesimally, are the special conformal generators. And really, where they're coming from is the fact that the theory has a much more surprising symmetry than just rescaling everything, which is dimensional analysis. It has symmetry under inversions. So the fact that there's symmetry under inversions is quite a remarkable thing. So the inversions, I remind you, takes the point x mu, and it replaces it with a point negative x mu over x squared. Negative x mu over x dot x. And this is really quite a shocking symmetry for a theory to have, if you're very naive. It's much, much more surprising than just the overall rescaling of everything. The special conformal generator is what you get if you start with a point, go to its invert point, translate by a little bit, and go back. Okay? That gives you an infinitesimal operation. The generator associated with that is a special conformal transformation generator. But this is really the juice. The juice is that inversions are a symmetry of the theory. And this does something quite nonlinear to the space-time coordinate. Okay? So it's not surprising that its action is not linear. In fact, you can write out what these generators are in terms of the lambdas and the lambda tildes. K mu has a normally a lambda mu index. I can trade that for an alpha and an alpha dot index. Okay, Freddie, we're using capital A's? Fantastic. Thank you. Okay, and this thing is indeed a quadratic generator. It goes like d squared lambda a lambda tilde a dot. It's not a linear operator. It's quadratic in derivatives. Okay, so we want to understand these symmetries as simply as possible, so we want to use variables where the symmetry is linear, acts linear. And that's the point of twister space. There's many points of twister space. And, of course, It could take a whole series of lectures just to talk about twister space, but I just want to talk about the very basic aspects of twister space that are going to be relevant to our story. We're not going to need very much at all. Okay? Quite apart from this technical motivation, of course, twister space plays very nicely with the more deeply holographic ideas you might have about what a dual theory might look like. The whole idea being that you replace points in space-time by null rays in space-time as the fundamental objects of interest. So if you want to describe a null ray in space-time, here's a null ray, some null ray in space-time. And the point is that all the points on that null ray of space-time can be taken to satisfy an equation that looks like this. That's called the incidence relation. Well, as I said, there's many ways that we can get into the subject, but this is a good place to start. Okay, so if you have a null ray in space-time, it's associated, it satisfies a linear equation. All those points satisfy a linear equation. This is the linear equation that they satisfy. You can see this very easily because if you have two different points x that satisfy the same equation for the same u tilde and lambda tilde, then if I have this for one, and I have the same thing for two, if I subtract the equations, I discover that xAA dot has for the same mu and lambda, if I have two points, x1 and x2, I apologize. If I subtract these equations, I find that x1 minus x2, AA dot, lambda tilde A dot, is equal to 0. That means that this matrix, 2x2 matrix x1 minus x2, has a vanishing eigenvector. And that means that x1 minus x2 squared is 0. So x1 minus x2 is null. So any two points that satisfy that equation are null separated from each other. In fact, all sets of points that are null separated from each other conversely satisfy an equation of that form. Okay. So that's the most basic twistorial correspondence, that a null ray in space-time is a one-to-one correspondence with a pair mu tilde, lambda tilde, that I'm grouping into a four-vector. Okay. Now, why do I group into a four-vector? Well, it's because conformal transformations act on that four-vector just like SL4 transformations. And that's extremely easy to see. In fact, let's just talk about inversions because that's the most interesting one. You see, if I take this equation and I divide by x squared, I get exactly the same equation back with the role of mu tilde and lambda tilde reversed. Alternately, if I multiply by x on one side, then I get exactly the same equation. The two x's here, because it's a 2x2 matrix, give me x squared, which is the determinant of x, times lambda tilde. And so if I divide this equation by x squared, I get exactly the same equation back with the role of mu tilde and lambda tilde reversed. So that tells me that the inverted point, all the inverted points on this null line are associated with exactly the same pair of variables, mu tilde and lambda tilde, but the role of mu tilde and lambda tilde reversed. So if I group mu tilde and lambda tilde into a four-vector, I see that inversions are just a very simple linear transformation that just swaps mu tilde and lambda tilde. Okay? Yes?
Can you elaborate to start with why you expect the amplitude to be invariant under conformal?
Well, this is the symmetry of the classical action. So we'll come back and talk about how it's broken and so on. But we're just making naive statements. The theory is conformal. We expect it's a good idea to talk about things in a conformal invariant. Of course, it's going to be broken by infrared divergences and so on. We'll come back to that point in great detail. Okay. So now, another basic aspect of this correspondence is that if you take two, so we can call these W. Okay. When all the variables are tildeed, we call them W's, and you can say that they have a SL4 index I, where I runs from 1 to 4. Okay. Often they're called Z's. If it's no tildes, we use Z's. If it's tildes, we use W's. Okay? Now, let's say you have a pair of twisters. So if you have two twisters, W1 and W2, then each one of them is associated with some null ray in space-time. And it's not so easy to visualize it immediately, but those two null rays intersect at a point, generically. That's very easy to understand that they intersect at a point just from staring at the equations. So let's say I'm trying to find a simultaneous solution of these two equations. If I'm trying to find a simultaneous solution of those two equations with the same x, I can clearly do it by multiplying this one by lambda tilde 2, that one by lambda tilde 1, and subtracting them from each other. And I find the solution that xAA dot is mu tilde 1A lambda 2 tilde A dot minus the other way around, mu tilde 2A lambda tilde 1A dot divided by lambda tilde 1, lambda tilde 2, contracted with each other. So there's a solution. Given two twisters associated with two twisters is a unique point in space-time, x. Okay. Is that manipulation clear? Okay. Now, notice that these equations would have been completely invariant had I done a general 2x2 linear transformation on them. I can take a general 2x2 linear transformation on these equations, and I'm not going to change what the equations are and what the solution is. So that tells you something. That tells you that this point x isn't, that there's many different points, mu tilde, many different points, W1 and W2, all of which give the same x. In fact, if you take any W1, W2, and do any 2x2 linear transformation on W1 and W2, then you're going to end up with exactly the same point back in space-time, x. Now, what do we call it when we have two points? What is the equivalence class of all points which are related to that point by 2x2 linear transformations? Well, you can say that these guys form a two-plane in four dimensions. So if you think about W1 and W2 as each being coordinates in C4, each just being simple coordinates in C4, then we're saying that the equivalence class of all of these guys up to 2x2 linear transformations is associated with a point in space-time. If I think about them as just two vectors defining a plane in C4, then any 2x2 linear transformation defines the same plane. So what we see here is a correspondence between a two-plane in four dimensions and a point in space-time. Okay? Is that clear? So W1, W2 define in general a two-plane in four dimensions, and they correspond to a point in space-time. Okay? Now, we often abuse terminology a little bit. Well, it's not abuse, it's correct, because of one more feature that's going to come about in a second, which is that we're going to find that these W's are going to be associated with the external data of the problem, right? They're not going to quite be the lambdas and lambda tildes. They'll be closely related to the lambdas and the lambda tildes. But that means that the little group action on the lambdas and lambda tildes that Freddie told you about is inherited by the W's. Okay? In fact, the little group action is much nicer on these objects than it is on the standard lambdas and lambda tildes. We'll see this in a second, but lambdas and the lambda tildes rescale oppositely under little group scaling. But for these variables, they rescale simply homogeneously. So that's one of the beautiful points that we're going to see in a moment. But that means that invariantly, what we should talk about is not the vector in C4, but the vector in C4 modulo overall rescalings. The vector in C4 modulo overall rescalings is nothing other than a point in CP3. That's just the definition of what CP3 is. Okay? So these twisters are points in CP3. Really, the way we've written them is more redundantly as vectors in C4, but because of the little group action, they're really points in CP3. And then these 2x2 linear transformations on them define this plane in C4 is what you would call a line in CP3. Okay? Is that clear to everybody? So we'll use that fact and therefore say and complete the correspondence here So a point in a null ray in space-time is a point in Twister space. And conversely, a line, so these wi live in CP3. Conversely, a line in Twister space is associated with a point in space-time. Okay? That's some of the most basic geometric relationships between Twister space and space-time. And again, the whole conformal group, the point is two things, that the conformal group acts like SL4 on W. Okay. So that gives a very simple way of thinking about it. Okay. Now, so far we're still talking about conformal invariants, ordinary conformal invariants. Yeah.
In general, don't intersect. So how do you have always a point given to?
This is all the magic of nullness in Minkowski geometry. Okay. So two points in CP3 define a line.
If we go back here, these are not really these are. Everything is complex here. Everything is complex. So these are really, these null rays are two real dimensional. So there's a two real dimensional plane, another two real dimensional plane. And now it's not obvious that they intersect at a point. But you might think if they intersect on a line. But in fact, they intersect on a point. And that little that little exercise shows that it's true. Right. Okay. All right, so we're still talking about ordinary conformal transformations. This was a big part of Penrose's motivation, talking about ordinary conformal transformations in ordinary space-time. So let's keep going with ordinary conformal transformations. Now, this way of talking about the conformal symmetry is very useful for space-time quantities, okay? Things that depend on x, position space-time quantities. It's less convenient for talking about scattering amplitudes that depend on momenta or depend on lambdas and lambda tildes, okay? So that's why something very, very nice happened when Witten wrote his paper in 2003 to help us go from standard forms of the momentum space amplitudes written as a function of lambdas and lambda tildes into Twister space. Okay? Instead of going from coordinate space into Twister space, going from standard momentum space into Twister space. And in fact, this motivation for doing it, for what we're about to do, you could say even without have ever thought about any of this stuff, okay, there's a motivation for doing what we're about to do simply by making the action of the little group as simple and transparent as possible. And we'll see that it'll accomplish exactly the same thing. So the idea is, and now let me say it as a statement about the whole superamplitude. Okay? So let's say I have an amplitude that depends on lambda A, lambda tilde, and eta tilde A. Now remember, this is an object which satisfies that under the rescaling, under the rescaling of lambda to T lambda, lambda tilde to T inverse lambda tilde, and eta tilde to T inverse eta tilde, has net weight minus 1 for every variable. Right? That's what Freddie explained to you earlier. So it's nice that it has a nice homogeneous weight, but it's ugly that it's treating lambda and lambda tilde separately, that it's rescaling them differently. Okay? So under this scaling, M goes like 1 over T squared, I guess, M. Okay. But it's ugly because lambda and lambda tilde have opposite scalars. We would like to think about lambda and lambda tilde as projective variables, but we can't independently project the variables, but we can't quite do it because one of them is because we're rescaling them opposite. Okay, so now, it's useful now for what we're about to do to imagine that we're working with lambda and lambda tilde, which are in general completely complex variables. We're going to imagine for the moment that lambda and lambda tilde are independent real variables. Okay? So we will not, for this discussion, we'll imagine that lambda and lambda tilde are not completely general and complex, but they're two independent real spinners. That, yeah. Sure.
If you did not complexify, then it will really be a line, right? It will not be a plane.
Yeah, if you don't complexify, the whole thing doesn't work.
The whole, right.
Finding so the x that you found by solving what would work.
That x isn't a Hermitian matrix. For x to be a real point in space-time, x has got to be a Hermitian matrix, and it won't be Hermitian.
It should be real, but not Hermitian.
It could be real, but not Hermitian.
But
exactly. That's right. If you make these guys real, it'll be real and not Hermitian. Exactly. If you make mu tilde and lambda tilde real, then all these points are real and they're points in real 2, 2 signature. Okay. So if we work with lambdas and lambda tildes as independent real parameters, then it's like we're working in 2-2 signature. Okay. This is really, at the moment,
this is really, and this was one of Witten's innovations, is just to let us get going. Okay. Presumably, all of these things make sense in general signature and so on, but the operation we're about to do is very simple to discuss in 2-2 signature, so we'll just do it. Okay? Once you get all the results, then you analytically continue, you're off and running after that. But at the moment, it's just kinematics. I just want to get some of these kinematical ideas out there, and they're easiest to describe in 2-2 signature. So here's something nice you could do. You could take this object and Fourier transform it with respect to lambda A. Okay. Okay. So by convention, then this mu tilde, okay, so it's conjugate variable we're calling mu tilde. You've never heard about any of that for a second. The conjugate variable is mu tilde. And what we're left with is a function of, mu tilde, lambda tilde, and eta tilde. Now, why would you want to do that? Well, one motivation is that now mu tilde's transformation under that little group weight, under this little group, is now the same as everybody else. Mu tilde goes like P inverse mu tilde. Okay? So now everything is homogeneous. Mu tilde, lambda tilde, eta tilde are all transforming the same way. And furthermore, one final beautiful thing happens. Notice that the weight of the d squared lambda precisely cancels the rescaling that you get under the overall weight. So this object, this new object M, maybe I'll put an M hat for now, this new object M hat satisfies that M hat of TW, I will call now this entire super object, which is mu tilde, lambda tilde, and the super component eta tilde, M hat of TW is simply equal to M of W. You couldn't want a nicer set of kinematic variables to describe the amplitudes with. And furthermore, it shouldn't surprise you,
that's right. Now this W you can really identify with that one. Okay? The
conformal transformations act on the W's like SL4, and they act on the whole super W as just 4x4 superlinear transformations. Okay? I forget what that group is called. PSU 2/2, whatever. Yeah. Sorry, I forget. It's 4x4 superlinear transformations. I should really know that, actually. That's kind of embarrassing. This is being recorded, right? That's right. Sorry, Matthias Stadacher. You know. Anyway, very good. So this is just gorgeous, because the external data of the world is now described in the simplest possible way. The external data are points that live on CP3/4. Okay? There's four, the W's, the super W's live in CP3, and there's four fermionic coordinates. Okay? Manifestly, they depend on three variables. We finally are using variables where there's 3 degrees of freedom associated with every external particle, which is the right number. Okay? And everything is manifestly on shell, everything is wonderful. If we Fourier transform back from Twister space, we can take any expression in Twister space, Fourier transform back to momentum space, and then we're going to get objects that are correct, have the correct weights, and so on. And the amplitude is a function of weight 0, or density, or whatever it's called, but a function of weight 0 on CP3/4. So we've succeeded in writing the amplitude in the sort of simplest possible, using the simplest possible variables. So the full super conformal transformation is then being made manifest in these variables. Now, if we had even longer for these lectures, we would spend an entire lecture or two in love with this twister space. Okay? We would look at what amplitudes look like in this twister space. If you take the expressions Freddie gave you, which already look pretty nice in standard variables, but still, there's these denominators, there's a delta function for momentum conservation, there's a delta function for supermomentum conservation, and so on. If you take those formulas and you transform them into twister space, they're just things of absolute beauty. They're made out of the simplest amplitudes, 3 and 4 point functions, are made out of little sign factors. Okay? They're minus ones and ones. They could not look simpler. And in fact, this is what got us started and what got Dave and Lionel Mason started in thinking about some of the structure that we're going to talk about, the incredible simplicity of these objects in twister space. And again, if it was a longer series of lectures, we could tell you the direct road that led from those things via these beautiful ideas of old ideas of Andrew Hodges having to do with twister diagrams. There's a direct path that connects those ideas to the Grassmannian picture that Freddie was describing to you, which we'll be talking a lot more about. In fact, you could think that the structure of those diagrams all along were telling us about the underlying Grassmannian. Anyway, so we don't have infinite time, so I won't get a chance to talk about it. I'll just leave it at this for now. Okay? So this is twister space to talk about the amplitudes, make superconformal transformations as manifest as possible, the kinematic properties of amplitudes as simple as possible. Any questions? So far, so good? Okay. Now, let's switch to a different symmetry. Just to be ultra clear, we're now talking about a completely different symmetry of the theory. Okay? It's confusing because we're going to use a lot of the same ideas and words and techniques and so on, but it may be confusing at first if you're not used to it, but so let me just stress that we're talking about a totally different symmetry. The conformal symmetry is a symmetry of n equals 4 for any theory, any gauge group, any n, anything. Okay? Just to stress the new symmetry that we're talking, and it's just a property of the Lagrangian. You stare at the Lagrangian, it's an obvious symmetry of the Lagrangian, it's preserved by quantum corrections, everything is fine. Smacks you over the head. You don't have to be smart to discover conformal transformation, conformal invariance. The new symmetry we're talking about is a crazy symmetry. Symmetry that's not at all manifest in the Lagrangian. And in fact, it's a symmetry that it's not a symmetry of the Lagrangian. It's in fact not a symmetry of the whole theory, as far as we know. It's only a symmetry of the theory in the planar limit. Okay? So it's a dynamical symmetry. It's not something that's trivially there in the Lagrangian. And this is the dual conformal invariance. Now, the way it was discovered has a wonderful and tortuous history, like every very interesting discovery. It was discovered by looking at the structure of high loop order diagrams in n equals, planar diagrams in n equals 4, and noticing that the diagrams made an appearance seemed to have this interesting dual conformal symmetry. Then it was discovered in ADS-CFT at strong coupling. Then it was discovered again at weak coupling. And it was discovered that the right way to think about it, you had to actually crucially make it all supersymmetric. So it was a full dual superconformal invariance. It's a tortured history. We'll touch on some of it as we go along. Something also significant, that this was all happening in rough parallel to the development of the BCFW recursion relations. Actually happened a little bit after the BCFW recursion relations were discovered. And then when the correct supersymmetric way of talking about all these things was understood, it was seen quite remarkably that each term in the BCFW recursion relation all by itself seemed to be invariant under this remarkable symmetry I'm going to tell you about. So that's extremely interesting because, as we'll see in a second, the reason why the symmetry is impossible to see in the Lagrangian is this symmetry lives in a completely different space than the usual one. It lives in a t-dual space to the usual one. And so it's the, again, it's the demand of expressing the original, writing the theory in a local way, using a local Lagrangian, is what's completely hiding all of this remarkable structure. And locality is the theme of this entire lecture series is locality is the enemy. Space-time is the enemy. We're going to eviscerate it. We're going to try to get rid of it and describe everything we can without it. And this is going to buy us something. It's going to allow us to see all the symmetries that the theory has without making any commitment to one description or the other. What's remarkable is that this is possible. And so we'll talk a lot more about that. But one thing, even before this, there were some quite striking features of individual terms in the BCFW answer for tree amplitudes. Individual terms could not be given a local interpretation in space-time. Individual terms had a pole structure that was not compatible with local propagation in space-time. Somehow all these non-local poles canceled in the sum that yielded the physical amplitude, but each building block, piece by piece, did not have this property. Then when it was seen that these terms were invariant into the dual superconformal invariants, that all of a sudden had an explanation. It's because these are building blocks that are invariant under all the symmetries. They don't care about one space-time or another space-time. They don't care about locality at all. Okay, so they're the harbinger of things to come, that there is some way of expressing things which just doesn't put the space-time in from the start at all. It makes other things manifest. Okay, so let's talk about what this is. In the planar limit, we can talk about ordering the external particles in a canonical way. As Freddie explained, stripping off the color factor and talking about single trace terms, we can talk about a canonical ordering to the external particles. So the amplitudes we're talking about have the external particles given in a particular ordered way. Okay? Now, when we write P equals lambda lambda tilde, we're doing something. We're trivializing the fact that the particles are on shell. Okay. So we do that at the expense of introducing a little bit of redundancy, right? Lambda and lambda tildes are not defined up to rescaling, but that's fine. That's actually good because that redundancy is the action of the little group. So everything is great. Okay. What we want to do is just keep going with this basic idea and introduce more and more redundancy so that we can specify some data in another form other than just giving momenta, such that we get out momenta that conserve momentum and are on shell. Okay? So that's what we want to learn how to do. The first step of that is to just use variables that make momentum conservation totally trivial. Okay? Well, to do that, since the particles are ordered, it makes sense to draw the following picture that I'm sure you've seen in many talks. Imagine laying the momenta of all the particles, p1 up to pn, end to end, on a piece of paper, on the board. Of course, this is a four-dimensional board. But we can certainly imagine doing that. Again, because the particles have an ordering, there is a natural ordering with which we can lay down the particles. First one, then two, then three, and so on, up to n. So here's p1, here's p2, p3, up to however many I have. Okay? Okay? The fact of momentum conservation in this picture is just that this polygon closes. So this is a closed polygon whose edges are null. And that motivates introducing some variables to say that the coordinates of the edges of the polygon here, let's just call them x's. So this space that we're drawing this picture in is some coordinate space for us. So we're going to write PA mu is XA plus 1 mu minus XA mu. So if I do that, I've trivialized momentum conservation. Simply by giving you a bunch of x's, I've guaranteed that the momenta all add up to zero. Is that clear? Okay. Now notice, again, I've done this at the expense of a little bit of redundancy. I can shift all the x's, just translations in x, don't affect anything. They give me exactly the same p's back. But that's fine. Okay. So there's a little bit of extra redundancy, but it's okay. All right, great. Now, the statement, the original statement, which later became super, but the original statement was that this dual conformal invariance is conformal transformations on this X space. This is not the original coordinate space. This is some imagined coordinate space where the units of the coordinates are momenta, are momentum. Okay? And it's the coordinate space in which this polygonal picture of the external data lives. Okay? So the statement is that the theory has invariance if you took all the data, you computed the scattering amplitude as a function of a bunch of all the external particles, okay, and then with some appropriate, after some trivial, after stripping off some trivial factors from the amplitude, let me even tell you what the trivial factors are. You see, this whole picture only makes sense on the support of the momentum-conserving delta function, right? So we're assuming that momentum is conserved in drawing this picture. So if you imagine writing the amplitude as the momentum-conserving delta function, if it's supersymmetric, it also has the super part of the momentum-conserving delta function in it. And then everything else, the whole picture only makes sense on the support of those guys. So once you divide out by that overall factor, you just ignore the overall factor, the thing that's left will have the miraculous property that it's invariant under inversions in this space. Okay? But totally non-obvious, completely, totally non-obvious. It's the sort of thing that could have been, this is one of the amazing things about this business, some of this data about tree amplitudes, at least for a fewish number of external particles, 5, 6 external particles, were sitting around in the literature in the late 80s and early 90s. This is something that was literally under people's noses. Okay? You have no idea that you should be looking for it, but it's just sitting there in plain sight in the structure of the tree amplitude. You go to this funny space, you do inversions on the space, and the amplitude is invariant. Shocking. That's the way just ordinary Yang-Mills theory. This is all at, even at tree level, where the n equals 4 part doesn't matter. Okay? Even at tree level, the amplitudes are telling you about another space on which a theory wants to be defined, a p-dual space to it. Yang-Mills theory has a kind of p-duality, bizarrely. Okay? And that's going to be part of the goal of these lectures, is to explain and understand how we see that manifestly. Okay? But anyway, this is the start. Okay, so this is the symmetry that we're after. I haven't given you the evidence yet. It'll be easier to get the evidence once we actually sort of write down the answers. But this is the symmetry we're after. So now what I'd like to do is tell you the nicest way of talking about this conformal symmetry. Once again, we have a conformal transformations, and every time we have a conformal transformations, the nice way of linearizing them is to use twister variables. So we're going to use twister variables again. These are not the same twister variables as before. I stress they're not the same twister variables as before. They're variables that were introduced by Hodges last May, I guess the May before that, and he called them momentum twister variables to remind ourselves that it's associated with this, with the coordinate space is the space of momenta in this way. Okay? But what we're going to do is define a new set of twister variables on which this conformal transformations are nicely defined. In fact, they will do more than making the conformal transformations nicely defined. They'll give us a beautiful way of talking about the external data where we just give completely unconstrained variables for the external data. And automatically, they will spit out a bunch of momenta that are null and satisfy momentum conservation. Okay? So that's the ultimate realization, the analytic continuation of this program of writing the momenta in the least constrained possible way is to write them in terms of these momentum twister variables, where you end up with a bunch of totally unconstrained variables from which you build on-shell lambdas and lambda tildes in a way that's guaranteed to satisfy momentum conservation. So let's see how it works. All right, so in order to do it, let's go back and take this X-space picture, and let's just draw what each one of these points looks like in the dual space. Actually, before we do that, I should have mentioned, something when I first talked about the twister correspondence. Let me just go back to that. Well, we're about to use it now. But remember I told you, that if you have a line in space-time as a point in twister space, and a point in space-time is a line in twister space. Okay? Amongst other things, quite apart from the fact that it makes conformal transformations obvious, et cetera, it has another very nice feature, which is it allows you to visualize Minkowski geometry, and particularly null Minkowski geometry, in a very useful and transparent way. The reason is that statements about points in ordinary Minkowski space turn into statements about lines and planes and other things like that in twister space, but those statements have to be projectively invariant statements. They're statements about lines intersecting lines, planes, and so on. Okay? So you turn every question about Minkowski geometry into simple questions about projective geometry. And thinking about how lines and planes and things like that in CP3 intersect, it's not fancy at all. You can think about CP3. It's a point in C4, right? So I can imagine the top coordinate has been fixed to be 1, and then I have three coordinates, x, y, z. And a point or a plane are just points and lines and planes in ordinary three-dimensional space. So you can just imagine them very easily in your head. Okay? And the geometry, this projective geometry, is very, very simple. We won't see really powerful applications of it maybe for a little bit, but we'll already see some beautiful, simple examples of it right now. So in particular, what happens if you have two points in space-time that are light-like separated? If two points are light-like separated, if two points have an x minus y squared of 2 in some units, okay, that 2 isn't the conformally invariant notion, right? That distance is not a conformally invariant notion. But if they're null separated, then null separation is a conformally invariant notion. So two points that are null separated in space-time correspond to what? This point corresponds to a line in twister space. That point corresponds to another line in twister space. And what could it possibly mean if X and Y are light-like separated? What's the only possible conformally invariant relationship they can have? They intersect, okay? So if you have two points in space-time that are null separated, X and Y are null separated, that means that the corresponding lines intersect. Okay? The line that corresponds to X and the line that corresponds to Y intersect. Okay? There's a general formula. I'll just leave it at that for now. Okay, so actually, let's go back to this picture. And so let's draw. So here's 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So in the way I was talking about things, that's x2 and x1. This is x8, x7, and so on. Okay? So let's just draw some of the points. So let's draw some of the lines that correspond to the points in the figure. Let's draw the line that corresponds to the point x1. Okay, so here's some line that corresponds to the point x1 in twister space, in momentum twister space, in momentum twister space. Okay, so this is momentum twister space. Okay, so this is the line corresponding to the point x1. Now, what about the line corresponding to the point x2? That's some other line. But importantly, x1 and x2 are null separated from each other. So that line had better intersect this one. Okay? So this is the line corresponding to the point x2. The line corresponding to the point x3, the line corresponding to the point x4, x5, and so on. Okay? So what we get is a picture of intersecting lines, each one of which intersects the next one. Okay? So associated with the polygon in the x space, we have a sequence of intersecting lines in the momentum twister space. Okay? This motivates something very natural. It motivates labeling that line is some line, right? I can label it by giving you two points on that line. But it motivates a particular way of labeling those points. Those points should just be associated with these two intersection points. In other words, I should associate x2 with the line z2, z1, okay? Where these z's now are the coordinates in the momentum twister space. So that's z2, that's z1. See, x3 would be associated with the line z3, z2, and so on. Doing this guarantees something. Doing this, making this identification guarantees that x2 and x3 will be null separated from each other, right? Because it guarantees that they share an intersection point. It guarantees that these lines intersect. So if we define that xA is associated with ZA, ZA minus 1, then we're done. You see, I pick n random momentum twisters, which is just four vectors, right? N random four vectors, Z1 up to Zn. It can be utterly random. I define each one of the x's to be associated with that line. Okay? I associate each xA to be associated with ZA, ZA minus 1. And I define PA to be XA plus 1 minus XA. And having done that, I'm guaranteed that I have a bunch of momenta that are null and sum to 0. Okay? With completely generic external data for the Zs. Furthermore, the dual conformal transformations, of course, act like simple SL4 transformations on these guys. Okay? So the action of the dual conformal invariants is just 4 by 4 linear transformations on these bosonic 4 vectors. Yes?
Yes, and you know everything is complex.
The condition that they are real, is it a simple condition, geometric?
Yes, that's right. The condition they're real is there are natural bars that you can, that there's a natural conjugation operation that you can do on any complex guy. Which complex conjugates and flips the mu's and the lambda tildes. And then the statement is like, if you want A, B to be real, then Z bar A, Z A should be 0. Z bar A, Z B should be 0, and Z bar B, Z B should be 0. But it's really just inputting the statement that the point X that we construct is Hermitian. Okay? So it's, sorry? That's right, very good. So the global translation in X is just part of this conformal group. It's just the translation part of the conformal group. So the overall SL4 has a part which just acts completely trivially. It's just overall translations in the X space. But it's part of the whole symmetry. It's part of this whole dual conformal symmetry. Okay? All right, now I want to stress something. This relation between Z's and X's and momenta in the end is completely algebraic. There's no Fourier transforms involved here. There's basically no work. In fact, we can actually do it. We can just go all the way and start with a bunch of Z's and just give the formula for what the lambdas and the lambda tildes are that are associated with them. So why don't we just do that, okay? I could derive it, but let me just tell you the answer. And you can see that it's extremely reasonable. Okay? So let's say I have a bunch of bosonic Zs. We'll talk about the super generalization in a second. So the Zs are mu's and lambdas. Let me leave room for the super part in a second. Okay? So that's the data. I give you a bunch of mu's and lambdas. And from these mu's and lambdas, I'm going to reconstruct some lambdas and lambda tildes. So let's give the formula. So the lambdas are the lambdas. Right. Yes. Huh?
They're dual twisters, right?
These are momentum twisters. That's right.
Dual or usual momentum twisters? This ones.
Well, if you like those W's, you might want to call dual twisters. These are ordinary momentum twisters.
But going back and forth from Z's to W's in any space is not
The momenta.
It is the lambda of the momenta.
Is it possible to define it in a
yes,
way
it
that
is the lambda of the
momenta.
Not, it is possible. It is the lambda of the momenta. In fact, you see it directly from that formula. If you like, all I'm doing for you here is just jumping to the end of the following five lines of algebra that we can do.
Take this definition. I mean, let's just call them mu and lambda. Okay? We don't know what it means, right? Derive from these the x's. Once you have the x's, derive the p's, which are xa plus 1 minus xa. And you will find, remarkably, that p looks like some lambda times some lambda tilde. That lambda you find is the same lambda that appeared here, and then you'll find some formula for the lambda tilde. Okay? So that's just the operation that we're doing, and I'm just cutting to the chase to tell you the answer. Okay? It's a very simple four-line bit of algebra to do it. So the lambdas are the lambdas. Okay? Yeah. Yeah.
Do you want to keep the convention where lambdas are?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
you're right. Thank you very much. Because otherwise, what I would say is wrong. Okay. So the lambdas are the lambdas. The lambda tildes. The lambda tildes are equal to the following formula. Just that algebraic relation. As I say, all we're doing here is going from here, taking the formula that x is mu a lambda a plus 1 minus mu a plus 1 lambda a over a plus 1. I just take that formula. I look at, that's xa. I look at pa is xa plus 1 minus xa. And tuppy it up, I get that each pa is lambda lambda tilde, with the lambda being the lambda that appears here, and the lambda tilde being related to the lambda and the mu by that formula. Very simple algebraic relationship. Now, it turns out that the super generalization is just what you'd expect. You put an eta here, and the eta here is related to writing the amplitude in the eta tilde representation. So always in these lecture series, we're working with writing the amplitudes of the original amplitudes in the eta tilde representation. So eta tilde a is equal to exactly the same formula. Eta a plus 1, plus dot dot, exactly the same fashion. And so let me say what the ultimate statement of dual conformal invariance is. Yeah?
We had essentially fermionic Fourier transform between eta tildes and etas in...
Oh, I'm sorry. These are different etas. Oh, yes. it should be obvious from context. Let me tell you what the invariant
problem with this business is. The invariant problem is that there's four spaces, okay? There's the original twister space. There's its Fourier transform related guy, so we should call the dual twister space. There is momentum twister space, and it's dual space. So there's four spaces we could be talking about. And there's space-time and dual space-time as well. That's right. It's a bit of a pain in the ass. But essentially, every time you see an eta, or the eta will be in momentum twister space, if we're not working in momentum twister space, the external, the Grassmann data will always be given the eta tilde representation. So if you see an eta, remember, it's in momentum twister space. Let's try to stick to that. Okay. Okay, great. So let me tell you what the statement is. So the remarkable statement is that if we take the amplitude as written in momentum space, now there's no Fourier transforms, no funny business. If we take the amplitudes written in momentum space, so m of lambda, lambda tilde, and eta tilde, that this is equal to, we strip off the momentum conserving delta function, we strip off the fermionic cousin of it, we even strip off this overall Park-Taylor factor, and the object that's left should just be a function of the momentum twister variables in a natural way. Okay? This should just be a function of the ZA. Which is SL for whatever the super thing is called, invariant. Invariant under 4x4 linear 4x4 super linear transformations. So that all of this makes sense. This is some crappy weights that we've got to remove in momentum space. We're not going to ordinary twister space anymore. So this all makes sense. This object, again, is a beautiful object that has weight zero under all the external particles. Okay, it's a function on CP3/4 of this new CP3/4. And for example, if you just want to look at its bosonic parts, the hint that it's all invariant is you'll find that the dependence on the lambdas and the mu's and everything groups up in such a way that the only occurring combinations that look like an epsilon symbol contracting four Z's together. That's the only kind of SL4 invariant object you can make, is just epsilon symbols contracting these guys, and you'll find miraculously you take standard momentum space amplitudes, crappy momentum space amplitudes, you take them, you write the lambda tildes in terms of mu's, you shove them, you strip off that overall piece, and what's left magically becomes a function of four brackets everywhere. Okay? And that's how you see the theory has a dual conformal invariance. Okay, so any questions about that? I think these are all the spaces that we're going to be talking about. Okay? So there's original twister space, there's momentum twister space. Going to original twister space is something which is, in this whole story, original twister space is, I should say paradoxically, it seems that original twister space is a deeper place to do physics, but it's a harder place to do physics, because going from momentum space amplitudes to twister space is not that trivial. We do it in 2-2 signature using this half Fourier transform that Edward told us about. And it's very convenient, but it makes sense in 2-2 signature. If we want to do things in 3-1 signature, it's more confusing. And you have to start thinking about higher dimensional contour integrals, and the story becomes more interesting. Momentum twister space is not defined for the full theory. It's defined in the planar limit. It's defined when you have this natural cyclic ordering and everything. On the other hand, it's much more closely related to ordinary amplitudes. Okay? It's, in fact, basically momentum space. It's jazzed up momentum space with this simple linear transformation that takes you from momentum space amplitudes to momentum twister space amplitudes. And so it has really come to pass that a lot of progress has happened in the last year playing in momentum twister space. It's closer to the answer. It's closer to things that we recognize. And so we can get going and make progress, although we all hope and suspect that what we're seeing has reflections and perhaps a deeper formulation back in the original twister space. But you'll be seeing that in the, well, probably not tomorrow. Even tomorrow is going to be some kinematics, and we're going to see how we see all these symmetries at work simultaneously and how this Grassmannian contour integral allows us to see all these symmetries simultaneously. But once we get going with actually doing computations and looking at amplitudes, we're going to be doing it in momentum twister space rather than in ordinary twister space. Okay. Any questions? All right. So let's move on to the last set of subjects. And this has to do with, now that we're tooled up with all the kinematics, we can start asking interesting dynamical questions. So we are interested in a dual theory for computing scattering amplitudes. And the first question you should ask, if you have any dual theory in mind for anything, dualities tend to work, don't tend to tolerate fuzzy thinking. So If there should be a dual theory, there should be something for it to compute. Okay? What should the output be? If there's some putative dual theory, what is it computing? You might say it's computing the scattering amplitudes, but then you'll immediately complain, people immediately complain, and say these scattering amplitudes aren't really well-defined things. Scattering amplitudes are infrared divergent. When you have massless particles, they don't exist. Okay? This was a statement made for a long time about the poor people who actually computed scattering amplitudes in n equals 4 had to tolerate a lot of flack in the beginning of all their talks. I remember this very well. I don't think I did myself. But I don't think I did. I was always more sympathetic. But, you know, they'd always get up there that say we're computing, we're doing all this awesome stuff in n equals 4, and always some wise ass in the back of the room would say, but what about infrared divergences? You know, it doesn't make any sense. You know, it's what are you doing? It's all nonsense. One of the great things that happened after Edwards' paper is that just people stopped complaining about that for no reason. You know, just so you could talk about it a little bit more. Anyway, it is a fair question. What the heck are you doing? These amplitudes are infrared divergent. How can there be some mind-blowing, awesome dual theory that's going to compute some crappy infrared divergent quantities? Okay. So that's the thing that we want to address. That's the first thing that we need to get straight. So in a general theory, at the moment, we don't have an answer for what that object should be. But there is an interesting object that you can talk about in planar theories, which is what we're interested in. In planar theories, there is something associated with scattering amplitudes, which is well-defined and completely free of infrared divergences. It's not the scattering amplitude. So if you think about the amplitudes at one loop, let me back up a second. Actually, let me back up a second. We could, of course, talk about amplitudes already at tree level. Okay? At tree level, amplitudes are nice, rational functions of the external momenta. Polynomials upstairs and downstairs, they're nice, well-defined functions of external momenta. So that's something you might imagine a putative dual theory calculating. Okay? In fact, this is what gave rise to a lot of impetus of the development of this subject, as I mentioned before, were the BCFW recursion relations. That allowed you to actually calculate them and see that they had these incredible structures that begged for a deeper explanation. We'll come back and talk about BCFW after I say some more general things. But so at tree level, everything seems to be well-defined and fine. But the difficulty begins at loop level. And the difficulty begins at loop level because of a reason that's really already there at tree level. You see, even at tree level, we say that there's a nice rational function of the external momenta, but if you were to convolute the tree amplitude against wave packets and actually compute an actual, honest, actual amplitude with, you know, convoluted with some waveforms and so on, you would hit those infrared divergences as well. The amplitudes have places where the denominators vanish, where you have collinear singularities, and those collinear singularities would hit you in the face as you actually did the actual amplitude over actual external wave functions. Okay? There's a reason why Rutherford found a divergence in the cross-section for Rutherford scattering. Okay? So it's there. It's there in the collinear divergences, even there at tree level. What's happening at loop level, you just can't avoid hitting them because you're doing a loop integral. You're integrating over all possible loop configurations, and you're hitting the places inside the integrand. In the integral, you're hitting places where these collinear divergences happen. That's where all the infrared divergences come from. They come from regions where the loop momenta become collinear with the external particles. Okay? So it's really the same. It's the same problem that's sitting there at tree level, which a little artificially at tree level you don't see because you insist on working with plane waves. Okay? But that's fine. So while you might suspect there's a theory at tree level and BCFW is a hint for what that theory should be computing, you might really want to go further and ask what it should be computing at loop level. All right. Now, we actually had an answer to this question a year ago, and we have a better answer for it now. And in fact, it's easier to talk about the answer we had a year ago by first giving you the better answer now. Okay. So the answer is the following. Just the way I described it, it seems to make sense that not the loop integrals, but the loop integrand is a well-defined object. Okay? Now, why this restriction to planar theories? I mean, isn't the loop integrand obviously well defined? You sum up Feynman diagrams, you know, there is one, D4L, 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 even at one loop. Okay, great, I'll put them all into the same D4L, done. Well, the problem is that the L in this Feynman diagram and the L in this Feynman diagram and that one, who says they're the same L? What do you mean by the origin of loop momentum space? There's no natural origin for loop momentum space. I can take any Feynman diagram and just shift L by a constant in this diagram relative to that one. Feynman diagrams don't tell me what to call L. There's an ambiguity. So there's no canonical way in a general theory, as far as we know, there's no canonical way of putting all the objects together under one integral sign. Okay? Let me say it another way. You could do it if you want, but the answer will be utterly gauge dependent, just crappy. Right? The integrand itself would be something that doesn't make sense all by itself. The whole integral would, of course, be fine, but the whole integral is what we want to avoid. It's infrared divergent, it has trouble, it doesn't make sense, perhaps, and so on. Okay? So it is not obvious that the integrand is well-defined in any theory. But in a planar theory, it's a well-defined object. The reason is the following. This ambiguity that we just talked about, the ambiguity is in terms of shifting what you mean by the loop momentum variable from loop to loop to loop. Freddie, did you talk about how loop integrals are x integrals or no?
Okay, great.
So let me just do an example. Okay. So let's do the following very simple example of what a one loop diagram would look like, just so we can express all of these things in this dual coordinate space. What I'm talking about now is purely a consequence of planarity. I should have emphasized that dual space where we write p's as x minus x. That you can do in any planar situation, regardless of whether or not the theory happens to have a dual conformal symmetry. These are just very useful variables to use whenever you have a planar situation. Okay, so let's do a very simple example. Let's imagine you have a loop integral that looks like this, just as a phi cube theory. So I'm just so let me just describe it in standard momentum variables in a second. Okay, so in these standard momentum variables. Let's say I'm doing Feynman, that's L, so that would be L plus P1, L plus P1 plus P2, L minus P4, okay? So we would normally write this as a D4L, okay, 1 over L squared, L plus P1 squared, L plus P1 plus P2 squared, L minus P4 squared, okay? So that's a normal way you'd write an integral like that. Okay, it's already very ugly. I mean, as you see, as you go, if you had more and more particles, you'd have L plus a whole string of P's added up together and so on. Okay? There's a much more natural way of writing this, which is to just recognize that I can call, for example, I can associate the loop momentum with a point X in this space. So let's say this is X2, X3, X4, and X1. So this loop momentum, what I call L before, I can say that L is actually X minus X2. Okay? So, this is 1, 2, 3, 4, just the external particles. But I can call that loop momentum, I can call this point, I can associate, because P is X minus X, okay? It's natural for me to say that this L is X minus X2. That L would be X minus X3. This would be X minus X4. That would be X minus X1. Okay? See, there's a natural dual diagram associated with the loop diagram that we drew to begin with. And so instead of drawing that, writing that, this trivial change of variable and working with X variables instead of P variables allows me to write that as a D4X over X minus X1 squared, X minus X2 squared, X minus X4 squared. Okay? So that's just, I'm just trivially rewriting the loop momentum associating with a point in this dual space. Okay? Now this is extremely nice because now if I have many, many other particles here, no matter what I have, instead of carrying around a lot of L plus strings of big P's, it's always of this form, X minus four points, those four points may or may not be null separated from each other. Okay, but it's four points that are simply related to the x's that we have on the outside. Okay? It's a very canonical, simple way of writing loop integrals. So now, in this language, let's say I have two sets of Feynman diagrams, this diagram and that diagram. Then the ambiguity that we're talking about, that I can translate the loop momentum in one diagram relative to the other, that ambiguity in this X space is just translations in X. Okay? However, I can canonically fix that freedom simply by declaring that the external particles are at fixed X's, fixed X1 up to XN. So for all diagrams, all Feynman diagrams, when I compute them, I declare that all the particles are at fixed X's, the same X's, X1 up to XN. That freezes this ambiguity and gives me a canonical way of combining all the diagrams together and putting them all under the same integral sign. Something I can do in a planar theory that I can't do without it. Okay? This is something you can do at one loop. If I were to say this in purely in momentum space without using the x variables, it's saying the following. Because the diagrams are planar, I can come up with a canonical way of what I mean by L for any Feynman diagram. Let L be the first loop momentum that exits point 1 heading towards point 2. Okay? Then that gives me a canonical way of identifying L in every diagram. I compute with the Feynman diagrams, the Feynman rules, whatever, with that L, and then I'm allowed to combine everything together under the same integral sign. Okay? So this is something you can do in a planar theory. Perhaps there's generalizations of it for non-planar theories. Perhaps actually there's a nice generalization for gravity, which is as far away from this as possible, but has a permutation invariance. Okay? So there might be something nice you can do with gravity. But anyway, we don't know yet. But certainly for planar theories, there seems to be a well-defined object, the integrand. Not the integral, but the integrand is something which is totally well-defined. Okay? At two loops and beyond, by the way, just to say this very quickly, at two loops and beyond, you might imagine having diagrams that look like this. Let's say this is 1, 2, 3, 4 again. And this. And now I can associate a point x with that integration variable, a point y with that integration variable, x here, y there. Okay? But now there is an ambiguity again. Do I label this with x or y or with y and x? I'm interested in the integrand, remember, now. So it's some function of x and y, which is not the same if I swap them. Okay? So what is the well-defined object? Well, it's obvious that the well-defined object is a thing that's fully symmetrized in these variables. So at two loops and beyond, you draw every diagram and you imagine the object that's fully symmetrized in the loop integration variables. And that is a well-defined object that allows you to combine everything under one integral sign. So we can talk about the integrand. What presumably happens when you compute with Feynman diagrams is you would do this. You compute with Feynman diagrams. You dot into the polarization vectors on the outside, and magically, all gauge dependence, everything disappears, and you're left with a nice, beautiful function of the external momentum. And the loop integration variables. So this is an object which is, again, a rational function of the external momenta and the loop integration variables. The tree amplitudes were just rational functions of the momenta. This is a rational function of the external momenta as well as the loop integration variables. Okay? So this is something sharply defined. When we do the integrals, we can get divergences. So let's leave doing the integrals to the end, but it seems to be it's data associated with the scattering problem for a planar gauge theory, and we should be able to compute it. Okay? And the claim is this is going to be the output of a dual theory where you don't put in space-time, you don't put in the standard recipe for computing loop amplitudes in quantum mechanics, and you get those things out rather than putting them in. Okay? Yes?
Two integrals to... or in orders in perturbation theory, can you see a relation between them? Can you see interaction?
Yeah, so this is something that, once we start seeing what the answers look like, the fact that, for instance, we should exponentiate, the results exponentiate, or the log of the amplitude looks natural and so on, is something that we will see coming up. This will be something that will come up naturally when we talk about it later, but almost every important physical property, like the quantities that are guaranteed to be finite, for example, we'll see are finite directly at the level of the integrand.
They're manifestly finite at the level of the integrand, not after you do the whole integral. But it's really, this integrand really has a life of its own. And it tells you, and it encodes all the information about, of course it encodes all the information about the answer, but also nice things, finite things, are manifestly finite at the level of the integrand. Okay. In this theory, in n equals 4, there's no UV divergences at all. Here, in general, that's right, in general, there's UV divergences, and there's everything. This object is well-defined. It's a well-defined rational function, and there should be some way of computing it for any theory. So what we're going to tell you about, a lot of it is uses the technology and the ideas of n equals 4, but it's clear that a very big role is being played by planarity and has very little to do with supersymmetry. In particular, the fact that this object is well-defined is true for planar pure QCD, and there should be a strategy for computing it directly of the same, hopefully not big generalization of what we've done already to determine the integrand for n equals 4 to all loop 4. Yes.
Can you group them together in an object that is perturbative expansion within these integrands by itself performing the integral?
Sorry, I didn't understand your question.
Can you define an observable element dependent perturbation theory, perturbation expansion within this?
Oh, probably, but at the moment we're thinking perturbatively. The structure of the, in the end of the day, on Friday, we'll see this recursive definition of the whole theory, for the integrand of the whole theory. And those recursion relations we know already in other contexts are much more naturally formulated in terms of some generating function whose expansion doesn't fundamentally care about loop order or the number of particles. There's some nice generating function. And it would be very nice to translate the recursion formula that we found into a statement about generating functions. Very plausibly, it's a nice thing about generating functions. At the moment, we don't know what it is. But I don't think there's something very detailed. I suspect there is a simple generating function way of talking about it. Was that the question you're asking? Very good. So, all right. So now you might say, so let's, great. So the integrand is well-defined. Let's just compute it. So we'll do that, but actually, in order to set up a nice way of thinking about it, we want to take one step back from the integrand and talk about something which is a little simpler than the. You see, the integrand depends not just on the external momenta, but also on the loop momentum variables. So it's going to be a very nice, complicated function. Rational function, but a nice complicated rational function of loop momentum variables and external variables. Okay? What we'd like to do is start off with a simpler version of the integrand, which is actually doing the integral, but doing the integral not on the standard way we do the integral, which has infrared divergences and all this stuff, but a totally canonical way of doing the integral by computing residues. These are rational functions of many complex variables now. And we're going to talk about computing residues of these integrals. So if you like, we're doing them on different contours of integration, not from minus infinity to infinity on the real axis for L0, x0, 1, 2, 3, for x0, 1, 2, 3, but on different contours of integration that encircle poles. Okay? Now, this is very convenient because now these are objects that are only, you're doing the integral. So they'll only depend on the external data. Okay? So they're the simplest possible proxy for the amplitude. They're the amplitude. The integrand computed not on the standard contour, but on, if you like, the contours the theory wants you to compute it on, the ones where the answer is as simple as possible. Okay? Those contours, the things that are computed on these contours that encircle the poles of the integrand, are known as leading singularities. So that's the first set of things that I want to talk about. Maybe I'll define what they are and tell you how to think about them, and we'll call it a day today. Okay. So what we want to do is talk about computing. We have some rational function of many complex variables, and we want to compute its residues. Okay. So this is a
Well, we can start motivating it by thinking about what the one-loop integrand looks like. So let's just start for a second and think about what the one-loop integrand looks like. So the one-loop integrand, let's even go back to L space. It doesn't matter for this argument. The one-loop integrand is a function of four variables, L0, L1, L2, L3. Okay? So what I want to do is I want to compute this object on some residue of this object. Okay? So I'm going to have a loop integrand that's going to be a function of these four complex variables, L0, L1, L2, L3. So what should I do? I need to somehow find canonically a point or some collection of points where there's a singularity. Okay? So I need to solve for four variables, so I need to come up with four equations. Right? I need to find a singularity where there's four poles developing. Now, all the poles, if you just imagine what the Feynman diagrams look like, you don't even have to compute them, but if you imagine what they look like, what do all the each Feynman diagram look like? It looks like a 1 over L plus some string of P's squared. Right? So I need to find four places where L plus some string of P's squared is equal to 0. Four places where that happens. And that will define a point. Right, that'll define a point in L space, and then I can try to imagine computing a residue of this integral around that point. But I need four propagators to be set to 0 because I'm solving for four complex variables, 4, L0, 1, 2, 3. Now, just imagine what that set of Feynman diagrams looks like. I get to put four intermediate guys on shell if I have a picture in terms of Feynman diagrams that looks something like this. Group the external particles into four sets in any way you like. So I'm going to take the external particles and I'm going to group them into sets of four. I'm going to break the external particles up I'm just going to divide them up into four distinct sets. If I have six particles, eight particles, I can group them up, for example. If I have eight particles, I can group them up. So two look like that. And we'll talk about what these pictures mean in a second. So this is one way of grouping the external particles into sets of four. Another way would be to have one of them on one end, three on this end, two on that end, two on that end. Okay? There's many ways of grouping the external particles into sets of four. The four is because we're going to cut four propagators. Okay? For every way of grouping the external particles into sets of four, there are Feynman diagrams. Just imagine all the Feynman diagrams where those four particles are grouped together and I have this propagator. This propagator, you know, if this one coming in there is L, if this is a set of all the momenta, let's say they all sum up to some K, that's L, this is L plus K. Okay? Then this is still L plus K, that's K1, that's K2, this would be L plus K1 plus K2 and so on. So for every way of grouping the external particles into four sets, I can hunt for a pole where I set that propagator to 0, that one to 0, that one to 0, that one to 0. Okay? That's one of the singularities of the integrand. The integrand has many, many poles all over the place. Okay? But for each way of grouping the external states into four groups, there is one set of propagators that I can try to cut. All right? Notice that something kind of lovely happens. In general, we don't know what the integrand is, but on this cut, this particle is massless, that particle is massless, all these external particles are massless, so whatever the heck this blob is a tree amplitude with these two extra particles, and evaluated at some special value of the momenta. It's evaluated at the special value of the momenta that's going to put all four of these lines on shell. So each one of these things is a lower tree amplitude. Okay? If I were to say this in X space, it's actually more elegant to say it in X space, what I'm doing is looking for a point X. So a general one-loop integral will have a pole that looks like some X minus X A squared x minus xb squared, x minus xc squared, x minus xd squared, where these xa, b, a, b, c, d are some of the external x's. Depending on how you group the four guys on the outside into four different sets, you'll have different sets of different values for xa, b, c, d. So what we're doing is looking for finding a point x, which makes all four of these equal to zero at the same time. So I want to solve those equations. X minus xa, b, c, d squared is equal to zero. Okay, so that's going to define some points. It isn't obvious ahead of time. These are four quadratic equations. And you can ask, how many solutions are there to solving these four simultaneous quadratic equations? I don't know. Very naively, if you were me, you would guess 16. But the answer isn't 16. The answer is 2. There's going to have to be exactly 2 ways of solving these four quadratic equations. And it'll take us too long today. But as a very, very nice exercise in thinking about momentum twisters, I strongly encourage you to try to understand why there's 2 solutions by translating this problem into a problem of lines intersecting lines in momentum twister space, where it becomes much more obvious that the answer is 2. But anyway, there's 2 solutions. It's not crazy that there's 2 solutions, because in general, these solutions are for complex values of x, right? So remember that, in general, I have complex values of x. Remember that parity is flipping lambdas and lambda tildes. And with real momenta, lambda tilde is lambda star. So parity is taking the complex conjugate. Okay? Obviously, these equations are parity invariant. So if you have one solution, you should have its parity conjugate as well. And since they're typically complex, if you have one, you'll have 2. Okay? So you'll have it, a complex point, and its complex conjugate, or its parity conjugate. On the other side. So there are 2 solutions of these equations. But anyway, so there's 2 solutions of these equations. But now what we'd like to do is, in this neighborhood, there's some numerator. It depends on x, and it depends on all the external particles, all the other data in some way. Okay? We would like to go in the neighborhood of where this is happening and compute a residue. So what we're doing is not computing, again, the whole integral, but we're going to compute a residue around these special points. I hope it's clear that one motivation for doing it, well, I said it already, but the motivation for doing this is beautiful, infrared, finite, completely well-defined data associated with the integrand. It is the amplitude computed on a different contour, and it'll yield well-defined functions of the external momenta. In fact, the functions won't be rational functions in general. They won't just be polynomials of the external momenta, but they'll be algebraic functions. They'll involve, you know, polynomials and square roots and other roots and so on, the roots coming in from solving these large sets of quadratic equations. Okay? All right. Yeah. Sorry?
What is the form of the singularity of the function of x?
It's always like this.
No.
Yeah.
If you look at the singularity itself.
Yeah. So is it always at the singularity itself.
Is it simple poles or is it?
Well, so right. So. Very good. So this function of several complex, well, this is a function of 4 complex variables, right? And it has a whole bunch of kinds of singularities. There's a singularity where just one of them is put to zero. That's already singular, right? So that's a whole codimension 1. That's a wall of singularities. I put 2 of them, it's a lower codimension. So a higher codimension. The most I can get is to put 4 of them, and then it's an isolated point, okay? And then in the neighborhood of that point, it looks like this. So that's the whole point about how you look for them. Okay? So, but it is a simple pole. That's right. It's 4 simple poles. It is 4 simple poles. Sorry. Yeah. Okay. So let's just talk. Since we've already encountered it here, let's just talk a little bit in general about how to evaluate such residues. What is the what's the formalism for talking about these higher dimensional residues? It won't take too long. So in order to do this, let's just talk generally about functions of n complex variables. And
in order to, so there's some numerator, which is a polynomial denominator. Now, whatever the denominator is, the denominator, let's say you have two complex variables. The denominator could be a function of, the denominator could have, I don't know, the denominator could have seven factors in it. Seven factors, each one of which are a polynomial in two variables. Okay? So what we're going to do is, however it's presented, we're going to always write it in a form. Nothing stops me from writing in a form where it's a product of n polynomials, where n is the number of integration variables. Okay? And if I do that, the idea is that I'm now searching for points. I have to find some special point z star, 1 up to z star n. And I'm going to do that by finding a place where these n polynomial factors go to 0. So I put p1 of z star equals pn of z star equals 0. Okay? So I find n polynomials, and I set them all equal to 0. In that neighborhood, I want to define what the residue of this rational function is. Okay, so how do you do it? Well, it's extremely simple. You go to the neighborhood of a place where this happens. Okay? In that neighborhood, each one of these terms is linear, right in the neighborhood, right? So in that neighborhood, it's reasonable to change variables from p1, from z, to the p's themselves. Okay, so let's be more pedantic and say u1 is p1 of z up to un is pn of z. But in the neighborhood of z star, this integral, so I'm trying to define dz1 up to dzn of this guy. So in this neighborhood, this thing looks like g of z star over u1 up to un. Right? That's what the function looks like. Well, I can change variables from the z's to the u's, and I can have a du1 up to dun. And I just have to pay a Jacobian factor. Okay? Times a Jacobian factor. And what's the Jacobian? It's just j is 1 over dpi by dzj, the determinant of this guy. Okay? Evaluated at z star. So far, so good. It's just formally true. Now comes the final point. Now, how do I define the residue du1 up to dun, 1 over u1 up to un? Well, you'd have to be pretty hard-hearted not to call that 1, okay? Because it's just du1 over u1, du2 over u2. You could officially do it by defining this integral to be over little circles where the magnitude of p1 is epsilon 1, the magnitude of p2 is epsilon 2, and so on. And then it would give you just the answer we just said. Okay? But clearly, we should define that residue to just be 1. 2 pi is equal to 1 in this in these lectures. Okay? 2 pi I is 1. Should be thought of as part of the measure. So the residue. So this is something that you can call the local residue. So if you have g of z1 up to zn over p1 up to pn z, then the residue of this, of g over p1 up to pn, is g of z star over determinant of dpi by dzj at z star. You like this as a definition for what the residue is. And that defines what the residue is for multi-dimensional complex integrals. Now, a number of comments, a number of very important comments are in order. First of all, a lot of the intuition from one complex variable is not true in higher variables. In one complex variable, you think of the contours encircling the pole. Okay? That's a very special case for one complex variable. In no sense is this encircling the pole. Instead, the contour is like n circles, right? It's a torus. It's a Tn. Okay? It's not an Sn. It's not encircling the pole. Associated with that fact is another quite remarkable feature of this definition of the residue that has to do with the little sleight of hand that we just did without talking about it, because everything is complex and it would look disgusting had we done it. But normally, if these were real variables, when you have a Jacobian, there would be a little magnitude sign around the Jacobian. Okay? This is everything is holomorphic. There's no magnitude signs anywhere here. That's fine. We're just defining the residue to be something. I'm allowed to define it however the heck I want. But notice that this residue has a very interesting feature. That determinant is naturally alternating in the p's. So this residue is not actually defined with this function, whole function. It's defined with this function in a particular presentation of the order of the order in which the poles are presented. Okay? So it's a naturally alternating object. Very important point. Nonetheless, this is a perfectly nice definition. Okay, I just defined it, but it has these peculiar properties. The fact that it's alternating is related. Of course, when you have one variable, the determinant isn't alternating. So again, with one variable, you don't notice this. But with more than one variable, it's associated with the fact that that it's not encircling the contour, and it depends on the order in which you wrap around them. Okay, so that's so it's a naturally alternating object. All right. But it's a perfectly well-defined canonical thing to do, and you can see why it produces algebraic functions, right? You have to evaluate this, the point z star in our example has square roots in general and so on. You evaluate this, you get something. All right, a final important point is generalizing beyond one complex variable to many complex variables is the analog of Cauchy's theorem. So when we have one variable, we know that if the numerator isn't growing too fast, so if the function is falling at infinity fast enough, or there's no pole at infinity, if you like, which I'll just assume for this entire discussion is true, for one variable we have the statement, Cauchy's theorem is a statement that the sum of all the residues of a function f at the sum over all z's of the residues of a function at z star is equal to zero. Right? That's a statement of that's Cauchy's theorem. The multidimensional generalization of that statement is exactly the same thing. So if this is f, okay, the statement is again that if you sum over all the z stars of the residues of f of z star, this is equal to zero. This is a very non-trivial fact. It's a very non-trivial fact, and it's known as the global residue theorem. The proof, I don't really understand it very well, but the proof involves mapping this problem, mapping this complex problem actually to an honest integral over an Sn that encircles the singularity and using Stokes' theorem to prove it there. Okay? But it's a quite non-trivial, very powerful, quite non-trivial statement. Sorry? Yeah, no, so it's presented in this form. So you present it in any form, in a fixed form, and then it's this statement about the sum of all these, I hand you g over p1 up to pn, that fixes what f is, and everywhere you choose it in the same, in a determinant of that matrix. It's the same order for all the residues. Exactly. That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. That's right. So really the way to think of it.
That fixes the order. So a given map is.
Right. So
whose components are P1 through P?
Right. Right. I think it will be good to stress that point when we talk about when we talk about unifying. At the moment, well, it's also true. We can think about this function as giving us a map
between from Cn to Cn, right? So I give you these, I give you G, and I give you some map between n copies, well, between Cn and Cn, and you can just think of this as defined on that map. So as Freddie was saying, that map defines the ordering for you, and so this is a function of that map. At the moment, this seems like an overkill way of making this statement. That way of thinking about things will really show its teeth in two lectures when we see that it's actually a powerful and important way of thinking about things. But I want to stress this: in the end, if you hand me a bunch of polynomials, I mean, it's just a remarkable algebraic statement about them. Okay, it's just a remarkable true fact. It generates tons of identities between algebraic functions. This statement generates tons and tons of identities between algebraic functions. Now, one very important difference between one variable and higher variables is that if I hand you the same function f of z, there's tons of global residue theorems associated with it in general. Because for the same function f of z, let's say we do that example again. Let's say f of z depended on two variables, and there are seven polynomial factors downstairs for fun. Seven polynomial factors. Then there are 7 choose 2 equals 21 ways of splitting the denominator up into the product of two polynomials. For every one of those ways of splitting into a product of two polynomials, there's a global residue theorem. Okay? So with this one and the same function, there's 21 global residue theorems associated with it in that example. Okay? So these residue theorems are much more powerful in higher dimensions than they are in lower dimensions. Now, when these residue theorems are applied to the loop integrand, that means that these leading singularities satisfy lots and lots of relationships between each other. Okay? The global residue theorem applied to the loop integrand tells you that the leading singularities satisfy lots and lots of strange, otherwise bizarre to understand relationships between each other, which are telling you, you see, the leading singularities are completely defined. You don't need to know any of this fancy stuff. You don't need to know the global residue theorem even. They're just defined in terms of these residues. I just told you what they are, right? You can compute a one-loop leading singularity. A one-loop leading singularity would look like looks like what I mentioned. Okay. So again, it's the product of a bunch of these, the residue is the product of a bunch of these lower tree amplitudes, okay, summed over all the particles that can run around the loop, and evaluated at the value of these internal loop momenta that would put all four of these lines on shell. That's a one-loop leading singularity. Well, a two-loop leading singularity would need 8 propagators. Okay, so here's a simple example. Because we have to have. Okay, so again, the definition of these objects, they're completely unambiguous. You draw any loop diagrams that you want. Make it look like a planar loop, split the external particles however you want, draw planar pictures, and just put all of the internal lines on shell. If you have L loops, put 4 L lines, put all of them on shell, and then just glue them together, summing over all the particles that can run around the loop, evaluated at those cut values of the momenta. So this is just a definition of what they are. Okay? If I hand you all the tree amplitudes in the theory, you can compute every leading singularity till you're blue in the face. Okay? They're totally well-defined. They look just like the loop diagrams, except they're cut. They're on shell. All the internal lines are cut. Okay? So there are totally sharp, well-defined data associated with the theory. Secretly, they satisfy lots and lots of relationships between each other, which are telling you they came from an underlying integrand. This definition doesn't tell you anything about the fact that they came from an underlying integrand. I'm just telling you how to compute them. But they satisfy many mysterious relationships with each other that are actually telling you they come from an underlying integrand. Those relationships are guaranteed by the global residue theorem applied to the integrand, applied to the loop integrand. But otherwise, they satisfy quite remarkable identities between each other. If someone hands you this as data associated with the theory, therefore, you notice that they satisfy there are a bunch of very interesting functions, but they satisfy, but they have mysterious properties. Let me give you an example. Let's say you're talking about MHV amplitudes. Okay? MHV amplitudes at any loop order, you can draw pictures like that. Incredibly complicated pictures, 1, 2, 12, 100, 1,000 points, 1,000 loops. Okay? It is, let's talk about the Park-Taylor amplitude, the super amplitude that has k equals 2. Is that okay? Okay. The super amplitude that has k equals 2. Well, at tree level, it's the Park-Taylor amplitude. At loop level, we could define all these leading singularities, okay? Now, you would think these are going to be complicated functions, right? They will have square roots. It'll look more and more complicated as you go to higher and higher orders. Incredible thing, you do it at one loop, two loop, three loop, you glue them together, you go through the whole song and dance, and you find all the time you get the same rational function. At 1, 2, 1,000 loops all the time, you either get 0 or you get the Park-Taylor tree amplitude. That's it. Not at all obvious in the definition. Glue these guys together in this way. It's invariant data. It's very nice, but it satisfies that mysterious relationship. Okay? They're all the same. The same thing happens for all the amplitudes. You take the sixth particle next to MHV amplitude, k equals 3 amplitude. There, you have the tree amplitude. You have some objects at one loop. And then the two-loop leading singularities, those algebraic functions, are the same as the ones you found at one loop. And then you don't encounter any new ones as you go to higher and higher points. Okay? That's one set of mysterious facts. Another set of mysterious facts is that these leading singularities satisfy linear relationships between each other. You know, sums of them weighted in certain ways add up to 0. These are crazy identities involving algebraic functions. And these identities end up guaranteeing important physical things like locality, unitarity. Important physical properties are related to these mysterious relationships between the leading singularities. But what I want to stress is that this is a way of defining what they are. They come as the residues of the loop integrand. But even if without knowing the loop integrand, I can compute what they are. I can compute all of them. That's a lot of data associated with the S matrix. And it has totally mysterious patterns in it. In that situation, these are completely well-defined objects. They satisfy mysterious relationships. That's when a dual theory is useful. Okay? And what Freddie will start telling you about tomorrow is the dual theory that computes leading singularities. So you could say the theory is just quantum field theory, quantum field theory in the loop integrand. But the surprising thing is that there is a second object that clearly does not care at all either about field theory or about Feynman diagrams, space-time, none of these things. It's a contour integral over the Grassmannian that Freddie mentioned. And the residues of that contour integral turn out to compute these leading singularities. And the global residue theorem applied to that contour integral generates all the identities between these objects and gives a sort of rational understanding for what these things are. Final thing I want to say about them is that these objects, whatever they are, you would expect them to see all the symmetries of the theory, whatever those symmetries may be, because there's no infrared divergences for these guys anymore. Okay, we're doing the loop integral, we're integrating the integrand on a contour where there's no reason for anything to go wrong. Okay, completely invariant, nice things associated with the integrand. So the theory had better have these objects better manifest the full Yangian symmetry of the theory. Okay? This way of defining them in momentum space turns out to have a very, very simple translation into twister space, where you can compute them literally by drawing these pictures. Now imagine these pictures are in twister space, ordinary twister space, and imagine just multiplying all these guys together in twister space, identifying the twister variables on this side. So that's W internal, that's W internal. This is another W internal prime, that's W internal prime, and so on. Just integrate over the internal variables. In other words, something that looks like the loop diagram in twister space, ordinary twister space. Computing loop diagrams in ordinary twister space actually computes back in momentum space exactly these leading singularities. Okay? So they have a very beautiful direct representation in twister space. That makes it completely manifest that they're superconformal invariant. It's less manifest that they're a dual superconformal invariant. And that's something we'll understand in the fourth lecture, why they're also dual supercritical invariant. So we do understand in the end why these things are fully are invariant both under conformal and dual conformal symmetry. So they do indeed show all the symmetries of the theory. And finally, associated with that, because we're cutting all of these guys and we end up computing them at funny, in general, complex values of the momenta, these objects do not look local in spacetime. Okay? They have poles in them. They're nice algebraic functions, but they have poles in them that do not look like legal poles that we would give a nice, decent local spacetime interpretation to. And that's very closely related to the fact that they do manage to manifest all of the symmetries of the theory. So this is a whole set of objects. It's defined at any loop order. The tree-level amplitudes that are computed by the BCFW recursion relations end up being a small subset of all these leading singularities. Actually, contain the tree amplitude as well, and I'll talk about that. I'll talk about that tomorrow. But that's I think everything for the purely kinematical part of our discussion. And tomorrow, Freddie can start telling you about how these objects emerge from elsewhere. Thanks a lot.